Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Well, I think I've just about got the time delayed down now on the number of seconds between the outro from the network and how many seconds you've got after you punch the button here before the Peach State Pandemonium comes up. So if I'm not looking for too many phone numbers, you know, like on the old Ed Sullivan show with the guy that's spinning the plates and trying not to miss one, then I think I can make that sound like I'm not forgetting what I'm supposed to do. Good evening, everyone. This is Jay West along with Bobby Simmons and Jerry Oates, who has now joined us. Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. Are you gentlemen doing all right this evening?
I'm doing great.
Doing wonderful. No complaints.
Well, we also have We also have a special guest with us on the line. And before he goes into too much more of La La Land, let's hear from Mike Norris. How you doing, Mike?
Oh, I'm peachy. They gave me the I don't give a damn juice, and so I'm sitting here and or laying here or whatever it is I am. And I'm not sure if I'm dreaming or not, but the Braves are ahead 3-1. So,
so that could be a nightmare. That might be a nightmare.
No.
Well, at least maybe you can go out with those thoughts. You know that the Braves are leading, and hopefully it'll stay that way. I also noticed that Charlie Smith's on the line. We'll get back with Charlie here shortly because once Charlie's on. He's on. Bobby, I was going to ask you how Mike was doing, but actually, since Mike is kind of just here, tell us about your latest talk with Mike and what you thought of the whole situation.
Well, the doctors have talked very positively. Mike is he's worried about it. He, you know, because we went through this one time before, and it was not successful. I'm going to attribute that to the hospital he was in and the doctors he had, because these doctors in Emory have talked very positively to him. They've been pro-aggressive in their treatment and making sure that he is ready for this. And he's looking at about 8 to 9 hours of surgery in the morning, and I think he's going to do good. I feel good about it, and Michael's excited. I believe this is going to be a positive step in the next phase of his recovery, which is getting his butt up out of that chair and walking again. And this is the first step. And they've already talked about the second step. They even mentioned that in the talks of this. So he's going to get there. Most of you guys know. I know Jay and Jerry does. You know, I'm closer to Michael than I probably am my own brother. And I'm apprehensive, but yet I'm excited, and he's going to do well.
Well, you know, Jerry, your thoughts on Michael?
Michael's going to do. He's going to come through this with flying colors. I know this. He's going to. He's got the right attitude, and that's everything. And he's got the right team of doctors. He's at the right place. It's the right time. And I just know he's going to do well. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. We'll rejoice over this.
Yep.
We're certainly wishing Mike the best. And it's been, you know, 3 years now we've been going through this. And, you know, frankly, I'm tired of it.
You're tired of it. It's December 2013.
We take a step forward, and then you take two steps back, and you know, I'd say, how's Mike? And Bobby'd say, well, he's back in the hospital, and you know, I just can't handle any more of that. So we're ready for you to. Mike, in his more lucid times yesterday, when I was talking to him, he had a lot of positive thoughts about the doctor that he's got. And what's going to take place. So We're all looking for the best, and you know, when we expect nothing less. Before we talk about a couple other things, and I'm going to probably get all weepy, but Bill Sellier left a message on the Facebook that from him and his wife Polly, that their cat Jody passed away, and we send out our sympathy to him. You can tell I'm an animal lover. Sorry. And Mick Karch, his dog Soupy, passed away. So,
yeah.
All members of the wrestling family. So, as you guys can see, my wife and I, we spend more money on our dogs and cats than we do on ourselves. And that says something right there. But some people just consider animals animals, and then other people consider them part of the family.
They are.
Yes, they are.
Speaking of that, Mike, you know,
and
seriously.
Anybody has a cat named Jody, and guess who he was named after?
Oh, yeah.
So anyway. You
know. Well, you know, Bobby, you went through this twice, you know, with your two cats you had remaining, and it's never a fun thing. But
I'm
going to
tell you
cat.
Something. This is the gospel truth, and I don't mean this may make somebody mad, but my wife, God love her, and God knows I miss her, and I have my bad days. She's been gone 2 years, 2.5 years almost. My cat, which was the one that died last, he's been gone 2 years. March was 2 years. I still sit here sometimes and cry over him, just because I miss him that bad. He was my companion, and a lot of people don't like cats, and that's fine. But Punk was my buddy, and I had not had a pet since I was a kid, and when he died, man, part of me died with him, and I won't get another one. That's one reason I won't have another cat, because I don't want to subject myself to that kind of love, and they don't live forever. But,
nope.
I mean, I just reading Mick Karch's post, I hurt for him.
Oh, my God.
Knowing that Bill and Polly were facing what they were facing today with their cat. They treat their animals like royalty, and you know, you just... You get so used to them, and when you don't have kids, they are your kids.
Yep.
So,
you
anyway,
count the days down. But our sympathy to both of them. And Mike particularly felt bad that I didn't put him on last week, but I didn't realize he was trying to get on, and he wanted to talk of, you know, I'm not going to say it relates to what we were just talking about with animals, but he wanted to discuss Gorilla Watts a little bit. So, Mike, you're on.
Yeah, you know, the deal with Gorilla Watts, or Sweet Daddy Watts, as he was known in the Mobile territory. His real name was T.J. Henderson. He was from Paducah, Kentucky, and broke in there with Phil Golden, who was the promoter there, who, if a lot of people don't know the name Phil Golden, Phil Golden was the brother of Bill Golden, who was the father of Jimmy Golden. So he's another one of those branch Welches. But that's where Watts broke in. And the, you know, the old wives' tale of him being given the name Gorilla Watts as a rib on Bill Watts during the Georgia Wars is not true. He was using the name Gorilla Watts in Arizona in the 60s. So he had been around, you know, using that name before. You know, Bill Watts, you know, ever came to Georgia. And also, you guys had mentioned Otis Sisbrunt last week, and I told Jerry yesterday when he and I talked on the phone that Steve Johnson and Greg Oliver's Heroes and Icons book, they mentioned football players who became wrestlers, and Otis Sisbrunt was a name that was brought up, and either good or bad, depending on how Jerry feels about it. Jerry was neither given the praise nor blame for Sisbrunt getting into the business. I don't remember who it was that they said broke him in, but Jerry wasn't mentioned at all. And
Jerry paid a lot of money to keep his name out of that book.
Well, you know what? You know, I don't blame anybody except Otis for trying to get him in the business. I mean, I felt sorry for Otis, and you know, if my name was in there, I don't care, because I tried to help the man, and he did something that 99.9% of us will never do, play in Super Bowls and win Super Bowls and play in the NFL. So
yes, sir.
He did something we'll never do.
Absolutely. So, got to
people
give him credit,
you know,
for that.
I don't make fun of him.
And, Bobby, on the Gorilla Watch thing, whether it was specifically a jab at Bill Watts or not, it's my understanding that Bill Watts didn't care for it.
Well, I heard he – I mean, he never said anything to me, but I heard he probably – I'm sure he took offense at it, and he probably thought it was directed at him.
Sure.
You know, I – you know, Gorilla – you know, he was just – he was not. They tried to use him. I mean, at the time he came in here, we were starting to get into that thing we talked about before, where our talent. You know, I wasn't a booker. I wasn't in the office on that end of the thing. I don't know what was going on, but I do know that our talent. You know, we were stagnant. We couldn't get new talent, and when we did get somebody new in here, it was generally somebody you never heard of, or you know. And I think they tried to use him in such a way to you know, feed him into some programs and so forth.
Right.
He would have been much like, in my opinion, a Happy Humphrey. You bring him in here for a couple of weeks, and boom, he's got to go. You couldn't do anything with him. If he ever went off his feet, he'd have never got up.
Well, there was a certain element of the audience who definitely liked him. You know, there's no doubt about that. I think probably he absolutely gave everything he could give, you know. You know, I don't think that to me he was one of these guys that, as you said, like Happy Humphrey, he was good for a short time. And he was not what you'd call, when you were trying to, let's say, make the sport look real, somebody that was going to give a lot of credibility that way. But he was somebody that was, at least on the short end, fun to watch. And I don't mean that in a negative way, you know, because a lot of workers were, that was what they were there for, you know, to give a little levity to the night with all the other mayhem that was going on. And he was able to accomplish that. But Mike did want to get that idea across, and we've discussed Gorilla Watts a couple of times, and that'll lead us into our main subject here in a minute. But Jerry asked the question last week when we were discussing folks about Jim Wilson and when he passed away. Wilson died, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution obituary, February 2nd, 2009, of cancer. Didn't go into any specifics as to what type of cancer. He and Weldon T. Johnson wrote the book Chokehold, which was published in 2003. And in that book, Charlie Smith has a picture. There's anybody that would have a picture in there. Charlie Smith's got a picture in that book, refereeing a match between Wilson and Lord Jonathan Boyd. And it was an all-South match, I would be pretty sure of.
No, yeah.
Many mentions on Jim Barnett and Eddie Mansfield in that book. Doug Smith was mentioned a couple of times, and I had a couple of mentions in there, nothing big. But possibly down the line we can discuss that a little bit more, and because I think there are some things within the book itself that are interesting, whether your opinions of Jim Wilson per se were positive or not. But at any rate, Jerry, that's the question you had on him, and that's the response
I
was able to come up with.
I appreciate that.
Yes, sir. From the wrestling news this week, Cauliflower Alley Club, which Bobby gave a good report on last week from Las Vegas, and the Wrestling Observer, they mentioned once again, guess who? Charlie Smith. The referee award was named after former Georgia referee Charlie Smith, who was there to present the award to James Beard, referee from Texas and Japan. And based on that, let me see if I can make this work here. 260. Yeah, well, I won't say that out loud. Mr. Smith, are you there?
Yes, sir.
How have you been enjoying the show so far, Charlie?
I enjoyed it. You know,
we've mentioned
you. Last week, Jerry Owens talked about his T-shirts. He didn't give them away. He's absolutely correct. I weighed 125 pounds, and I asked him to give me a T-shirt. He said, no. I said, well, I'll stand out front and tell people I work out at Ocean's Gym. He can only give me a T-shirt. You believe a 129-pound man standing out front of the Oaks' gym until he can work out there? But Jerry, when you give me a shirt. You remember that, Jerry?
Charlie's referee shirts in those days didn't have but one stripe.
Another time, Jerry was running town, and his sister was selling tickets. And I told
him. Did you get knocked off, Charlie? I didn't do that on purpose. Who knocked Charlie off? I'm not going to take responsibility.
It could be that phone he's got. He's got a cheap phone, I think, because it does that all the time. It may have been.
Anyway, if he comes back
for,
on.
For Smitty to, go ahead, Jay.
I'm gonna tell him that Mike cut him off if he comes back on here. But I'm looking for it.
We were mentioning wrestling books and everything, and I've been catching up on my ratings since I've been here in the hospital, and I just finished Jack Briscoe's book, which I highly recommend. If there's anybody out there that has not read it, I loaned my copy to Charlie Smith. But and I know this is something that Jerry has mentioned before, but I thought it was good of Briscoe to include it in his book, that the day after he won the title in Houston, he caught the red eye flight out of Houston, and the night he won the title, and had to do Atlanta TV the next day, and his opponent on Atlanta TV was none other than Jerry Oates, and he praises Jerry very well for, you know, being a good worker and giving him a good match and everything. So
he was a
clear Jerry player. You were the I guess the sounding board, because weren't you Terry Funk's first match after he won the title?
Yes, I was.
Wow.
Yep.
That's
got to be real exciting, driving to a town, knowing you're going to work with Jack Briscoe, and get there and realize you're working with Terry Funk.
Yeah, it was a shock, Bobby.
Did it change your philosophy on the match any, Jerry, when you got there?
Well, I had worked with him for two straight weeks prior to that, and I thought I was going to get a reprieve with Jack. But I didn't.
Charlie Smith, you're back on the air.
I was the type, you know, it didn't matter. You know, it was what it was, and I just, you know, I was just thankful I got title shots with these guys. That's all, you know.
Well, it certainly meant, you know, to get a title shot with a champion any time in their career, but to be the first guy to, you know, to get in the ring with them, I mean, that goes down in the record books right there. People don't forget that sort of thing. But I think it says a lot for you as an individual, and also it's, you know, somebody that, a worker that the promoter or the booker, whoever, would want to show the capability of not only the new champion, but also of the type of people that they were putting up against the new champion when you were the one that, you know, were the first opponent for them. And kudos to you on that, Jerry.
I appreciate that.
Okay. Also, Charlie, you are back on the air, by the way. Mike cut you off.
Telephone.
Get a real phone, man. Jeez.
You're not supposed to pay phone at a Waffle House or something, are you?
He's got one of them help me, I've fallen and can't get up free phones that they give away, you know. He don't want to, he just, at least 3-4 times a week we'll be talking and he just goes away.
But he always comes back no matter what, right, Bobby?
He's like bad money. He shows back up.
Okay, the ASWA, the All-South Wrestling Alliance. We've discussed the promotion war from late 72 to late 74 in Georgia, and it what happened with that really changed the look of Georgia wrestling. At least that's the opinion of a lot of historians and people that were there at that time. Tonight we want to focus more on the two-year history of Ann Gunkel's All South Wrestling. And I'd like to set up a couple of dates here and then just open it up. We'll start with Bobby on his thoughts on this. But August 1st, 1972, Ray Gunkel, who was probably the most popular wrestler in Georgia and a major stockholder, which most of the fans had no knowledge of, died after a match in Savannah, Georgia. And 4 months later, on November the 24th, 1972, Ann Gunkel All South Wrestling Alliance held its first card. So the question is, in less than 4 months, how was that able to take place, Bobby? You know, just to start with your recollection on between August 1st and November 24th, I know you were very young and, you know, you weren't a real big player at that time, but you've heard probably more recollections than anybody else on that situation.
When Ray died, and here again, Charlie may remember this, you may not, but I called the office that morning. I got up that morning and I heard it on the news, morning newscast mentioned it. And I call the office. Cause normally, at some point during the day, I would have showed up to see if Charlie had anything for us to do. And I called over that morning, and Charlie said it was true. And he told me to, you know, he said, you know, probably be best to stay away that day. And we did. We didn't go over there that day at all. I think it was very surreal to everyone. It was so unexpected. And, you know, like any other business, I mean, the wrestling business, I guess, was, I don't know if you can say it was very family-oriented, if that's the right way to put it or not, but the wrestling business was so close-knit, especially back in that time frame, because kayfabe was very much alive, and everything's, you know, you kept everything within the circle, within the family. So it was a very surreal time, even just, you know, on the outskirts of the business like I was then. I get, you know, and there again, I've heard all the stories that, you know, that the rumors got out that, of course, the Welches and the Fullers and so forth were going to try to take over, and their story was they were going to run the business and send her money and I guess she had been told by Ray that if anything ever happened to him, for her to show up, not to just sit back and let them take it away from her. So she of course, when she heard about the meeting they were going to have or whatever was going on, she showed up at the office before they got there and was sitting there waiting on them. You know, her and Tom had been, all of this is things I've been told. Tom had been promised by Ray he was going to sell him part of the business or points in the business, going to make him a shareholder. Here again, we're talking about the South, and it's a realistic thing. There was still a lot of racial overtones in the South in the 70s, and Tom being of Spanish descent, I'm sure that played into it a little bit, because all the owners at the time were part of the Southern White Boy Gang, and so you know that played into it. They were after all of that went down. You know, they kind of told Tom he wasn't going to be given any points, and I think that played into his decision to go with Ann. Charlie Harbin was Ray's office manager. He didn't know where he was going to fit in because he wasn't part of that clique. So he thought he was probably going to be out. That probably led him to go with Ann. And all the guys just were, you know, told that it was going to be good, and it went from there.
What, if anything, do you know about Ed Capel's status? Was there ever any thought that he was not going to go with the new promotion, or had he, you know, said right off that's what he wanted to do?
I really don't know. You know, I honestly think, had Ed decided to stay, they would have probably, he would have probably stayed if he'd decided to stay with the NWA promotion, he probably would have kept the TV. He was the face of the TV. People knew who he was. people respected him. People he had a lot of credibility as far as the Atlanta TV show was concerned. As a matter of fact, you know, when you thought of it, Live Atlanta Wrestling, you thought of Ed Caprell.
Absolutely.
You know, so I think he would have probably been well off either way. But there again, as everybody left, I really don't know what the mindset was because it's never been discussed. I've never talked about it with anybody. But, you know, I honestly think when Ann went in business, I honestly think that everybody had the opinion that they were going to win that little battle, whatever the battle was going to be, and that they were going to be
right.
The promotion in Atlanta. So I don't know what finalized his decision to go, but that was, you know, I just kind of think that's the people were scared. They were afraid. They didn't know what was going to happen. And, you know, in hindsight, I can see this. But they all made a decision based on what they thought was best for them at the time. And, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but it worked out well for everybody, I think. Everybody did okay.
Well, you know, talking about hindsight there, had Ed decided to stay, and I'm in agreement with you, he had been around so long, and he, you know, he had his own style, but it was certainly a very credible professional style in what he did. You know, think about what the difference would have been in regard to Gordon Soley had he not gotten that opportunity to go with what then became Georgia Championship Wrestling. It's, you know, it would have been a whole different ball game as far as later on as to how Gordon would have been seen. Not that he was any less credible, but I think probably a lot less well-known than he would have been being able to take that job.
Yeah, if Caprell had stayed and when the Superstation thing hit, who knows what would have happened. And then again, you don't know how long they would have kept him.
That's
they might
true.
Have, you know, I mean, there's just no way to know. I do think Caprell was very capable of handling the show. He would have done a good job. But there again, you know, things happen for a reason. And
right.
He gave Ann Gunkel show credibility because people knew who he was. And, you know, you got to remember when that Georgia show first started, they kind of did a little musical chairs thing there for a while. They had Les Thatcher and all good guys, but the Sterling Golden came in. Was that his – not Sterling Golden, Sterling
Brewer.
He came in for a while. I mean, you know, they kind of – they were looking. They were trying to figure out what they were going to do. And when they finally decided on Gordon, you know, having Gordon Soley do Atlanta TV was not an inexpensive proposition.
No.
there was some expense involved in that. Not only the cost of paying him, but you had to fly him in every week. You had to put him up in a hotel every week. You know, you had to cover his expenses to some extent. So it was not it was expensive to do that.
Well, the TV show continued, you know, in between those 4 months as Live Atlanta Wrestling. And not only was it on Saturday, it was also being shown again on Wednesday nights. And one of the key things that took place, I guess, and was a shocker to so many people, I think, including a lot of the insiders, was when Tom Renesto unmasked.
Nobody knew that I know of except Tom and Jody. Jody was in Japan at the time. And I've heard Tom tell this story he called Jody in Japan and talked to him. And here again, I'm telling you what I've been told.
Right.
So, you know, Jody may have a different perspective, but my understanding was he talked to Jody in Japan, told him what he was going to do, and Jody tried to talk him out of it. Just strictly from a dollar and cents financial thing, the
right.
Assassins were still a very viable money-making tag team.
Yes.
And he, you know, Tom just felt like it was a business decision he had to do. Number one, for his family, for whatever reason he came up with. I remember I was standing behind the camera that day. I was probably 10 feet from them when him and Caprell did that interview. They were standing by the ring. And when he reached up and took that mask off, I could not believe what I saw. And he walked right by me and never said a word, just went on back to the dressing room. But nobody in the dressing room knew he was going to do it. Capel did not know he was going to do it. He never told a soul. He just went out and did it.
Well, if you look at the, if you could see a picture of the expression on Ed Capel's face, and I can still see it in my mind, it was obvious that he didn't know that was getting ready to take place. Tom was, but you know, my thoughts on this: if Tom was going to be an executive with All South, that it would basically be impossible for him to continue to be a mass man, right?
Right.
And
Go
ahead.
Well, he had done it for you. I really don't know what all the, I don't know what all his reasoning was. Say he couldn't do it. Yeah, he might could have. He did it for years, working, you know, as a booker, as an office person, and as I said, those that knew Tom that weren't familiar with the business, you would have thought he was an attorney or some kind of businessman. You would have never imagined he was a professional wrestler.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I saw the assassins in their half masks many times, you know, particularly over at the sports arena when they would have matches over there. And I saw Tom a couple of times in the little ticket office himself. And, you know, you'd never put two and two together, you know. It was just, there was, you know, that guy just didn't make you think of the assassin number one unless you were to hear him talk.
Yeah.
That would have certainly given it away. But you're right. He certainly didn't give that impression when looking at him that he was considered one of the top heels in the wrestling business. Charlie, when did you find out that All South was going to start?
I heard a rumor two or three times. And one Monday morning, Tom came in office, and he told me, well, today is today. Everybody's leaving. He said, I want you to leave first and go over to Peachtree Industrial, wherever the office was, out there in Chamonix. And old Silvertown, you know, he could talk anybody out of anything. And you talk about Capital. I'd be raising Capital went with Ann. He knew that Ann had a lot of pull with Channel 17 with Tia Turner. And he knew that Ann was going to get a spot on Channel 17. And he didn't know if the other team was going to have Challenge 17. And he went, that's when he went with Ann. Because Ann had a lot of pull with Turner, and Turner liked Ann. They'd been friends for years. And which was true. Ann got the spot on Challenge 17. And Capital was in.
Well, you know, he had a, by that time, he was no longer a announcer per se, other than doing the wrestling and, you know, a few spots here and there. He had an advertising agency. So that
yes,
made sense for him to be interested in going to where the money was as far as advertising was concerned.
That was his number one thing, his advertisement.
Right. So, you know, in 4 months here, When it was actually announced on Thanksgiving Day, I believe that's the day it was, of what had happened, and the poor Ann Gunkel, who was the widow of Ray Gunkel, you know, how things were put out at that time, and the poor old doddering Paul Jones and his side of it. You know, I had a news card, an ID at the time, and I went down to the wrestling office, and there was a couple of guys sitting around in there, and they looked like they didn't know what in the hell was going to happen next. And so it's, I believe, really and truly, it left a whole lot of people by surprise. Leo Garibaldi was actually doing on-air spots for a couple of weeks there till they got Sterling Brewer, and they drug Paul Jones out, and you know, it was just a very, let's say, less than major market looking situation as far as just putting together the advertising the first couple of weeks as to what's going to happen with the Atlanta booking office. And I digress, because that's not really what we were going to talk about to a great length at night. But at the same time, once again, you basically cleared the place out, as we've talked about. But what I'm wondering is, and once again, chime in, how is a booking office, a ticket sale office, and the initial arenas put together within that time frame without the folks over there at the Atlanta office that were left knowing that was taking place?
Well, everybody, go ahead, Bobby.
Well, I was going to say, it's Jerry can better answer what was being rumored. You know, nothing's a secret. Okay, I mean, it's like something happens and it spreads like wildfire. I don't know if Jerry was hearing things in other where he was working in other territories or not, because I was strictly, again, I'm on the fringes. I'm not even actually technically in the business other than working for Charlie Harbin at this time. But as I learned after I got into the business and started working in the office, you can do anything and keep it a secret, because it depends on who you're working with. I do not know what the deals were that were cut, but you got to remember, when Ann went in business, number one, we kept Augusta. Steve Manderson was the promoter there. He agreed to come with Ann, okay? So, you know, Manderson's not going to tell anybody what he's doing, because he don't want the Atlanta office down there, you know, messing with that contract he had with Bell Auditorium. Mr. Newman in Savannah agreed originally to come with Ann. So, Mr. Newman, I'm sure, is not telling people what's going on in Atlanta, because he does not want them messing with his deal, whatever his deal was. Mr. Ward originally was going to go with Ann. There again. So all of these deals had been cut under the table. Mr. Ward decided to stay. You know, Mr. Newman, after a short amount of time, decided to go back with the NWA office. But Athens, Georgia, Tip Allman, Jerry Farmer, man, known the building up there, they agreed to come with Ann. So all of these, you know, I don't know what kind of meetings were held, but all of these things were done before Ann said, okay, or before they made the announcement, we're in business. Now, the way I understand it, the meeting with the guys took place on a Wednesday, and I don't know where it took place, don't know who, but I know that the only two people that I know of that did not show up at the meeting that day were Rock Hunter and Bob Armstrong. And because Columbus ran that night, and they were the only two guys that showed up that night.
Al Cochran.
Yep, that's what my understanding was, that Cochran and, of course, Bob Armstrong, who was part of the main roster, and then I guess Roy Lee Welch, because of the tie-in with the family business, were basically the only three that were left that, you know, the Atlanta audience really had any knowledge of as far as the guys that were working there then. Obviously, there were some guys that were brought in very quickly that had worked in the booking office, the NWA office previously, that were known to the Atlanta office. But you had to really start over with all the programs. You had to start over with everything. Those first few weeks, Bob Armstrong was, in the main event with Buddy Cope. And three weeks straight. But eventually it started leveling off a little bit. But, Bobby, what you're saying there about, the folks that had the arenas and things like that, that makes a lot of sense. Plus, Ann had, you know, outside of certainly the business of wrestling, she had a lot of friends, and she had a lot of people, as I understand, in high places that she could look for help, correct?
Yes. Yes, she was very well. Ann was very well connected. She was number one. She was in the hotel industry before her and Ray married. She had a lot of contacts through that part, social contacts, business contacts. Then, of course, after she married Ray and she had her children, and she was away from that. She had quit her job. She was a housewife. I don't know if that's a proper term to use anymore, but Also, Ann was a socialite. She was very well, she was into different organizations and different charities and different things that she did. And so she had a lot of contacts, and a lot of people knew who she were, who she was outside of the wrestling business. So naturally, when she played that card of being the only female wrestling promoter in the country, and the widow of the late great Ray Gunkel, and it was a natural thing. She drew a lot of publicity. She was on What's My Line. She did. She got some national TV exposure, and Ann was a good-looking woman. So anytime there was a photo op and she was there smiling, it was newsworthy. So it was all of that played to her benefit when she first started up.
Right. I was going to say she certainly wasn't hard to look at. So from a photography standpoint, you're right. They were going to be clamoring to get shots of her, particularly with these big wrestling guys. And that made a lot of sense, too. Jerry, you've talked about this before, but when All South started up, where were you and what were the contacts made with you?
I was in Montgomery. And I was already booked back in here prior to Ray's death. I was already booked. So he passed away, and I started like the next. Well, whenever Gunkel started, I was coming in. When Ann started, that was my first week. And I made several shots for him, and I was tugged and pulled and yanked and my phone was ringing off the hook, don't go with him, go back with, the NWA, this and this. And, I had to weigh the options. And I guess it was best for me, but I hated it. I hated working for the people in Atlanta that I worked for. I hated it. And I hadn't been in the business all that long, but I hated it.
How long had you been working as a wrestler? I know you'd done other things in the business, but how long had you actually been wrestling at that point?
Well, I started in March of 1970, and whenever that split was, but that wasn't full time. I for March, April, May, June, July, August. I probably started full time August to September, full time in the business in 70. So then, whenever that happened. That's where I was. I was caught in a trick. So I went back with the original group, and in a way I regretted it because I hated working for the people that was running Atlanta. I hated it. You could see, it was that Tennessee mentality. It wasn't even what I was used to. You got to remember, I was young in the business. I was green as grass, but I started in Florida. And when you start down there, or if you had started in Georgia, as it was prior to all this, it was just different. And it was like, I don't know. And the thing that I hated the most, I'm going to ask you guys, who was affected the most by Ray Gunkel's death?
Probably the guys in the business.
Huh?
Probably the guys in the business.
Ann Gunkel.
Yeah.
She was affected more. People don't talk about her like they should.
Yeah.
I look at this, if that was my wife and I was Ray Gunkel. Because and I know those people that come in and the ones that already had a piece of the action, that wasn't going to work with that woman staying there.
No.
They wanted that woman gone. You know how much they'd have paid her if she'd have just said, okay, I'm going to keep my percentage and get out of the way. You know how they'd have paid her? Nothing. I'm just telling you. They would have. That woman, I felt so sorry for her, and even at the end of her life, she died, it was awful, and she fought a heck of a game. She fought a hell of a battle. And that guy was put in the ground, or the day he dropped dead over here in Savannah, Georgia, her life was over. If she knew it.
Let me pose something at you from a business standpoint. And Jerry, you be a businessman, you can even though you're talking about what those guys were going to do. you know, I mean, I can't read their minds, but my instinct tells me they weren't going to do nothing but steal the business from her. That was the plan from the get-go.
That was going to happen, Bobby, sure as we're talking tonight.
They had, when she left there, when she started her own business, she still on paper owned the majority of stock in that promotion.
I never understood how it went from there, though.
You know what they did? They dissolved the corporation and started another one.
Right. I mean, it's
remember,
like
they did away with ABC Booking, and it became
mm-hmm.
Mid-South Sports.
Yeah, the value of the stock went from whatever to zero.
I was working for those thieves.
Yep.
Well,
they
like I said,
do the same thing. They were going to do the same thing to my father-in-law over here in Savannah, Georgia. I'm telling y'all, I told this story. They was going to steal Savannah and this whole East Coast from him. The towns that he had used to have some good spot shows up and down over here, little spot shows. It was a great area over here. I know when Garibaldi used to book Georgia, this place used to sell out every Tuesday night over here. It was a great town. And they had their mindset they was going to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they was going to try to get rid of Fred Ward like all the rest of them had done years prior to this.
Mm-hmm.
They talked about Fred Ward ran opposition off. Hell, he defied them. He defied them. Those were his towns. He took care of them, and he ran them the way he saw fit, and he battled them. Even Ray Gunkel, he battled them all, and he stayed. Whether people liked him or not, he did a heck of a job. And over here, that was going to go on. They was going to steal this. There was a bunch of thieves up there, I'm telling y'all. I work for them. I know. Charlie Smith knew those people, too. They're nothing but a bunch of cutthroats. And do you know how stupid they were? They could have taken this thing and made it. She was now the promoter on paper.
Kept
over Senate. They could have made that the greatest, biggest thing, the first woman that ever, I mean, it could have been unbelievable. But
mm-hmm.
they had this Tennessee mentality, I'm telling you.
The
ego wouldn't let them do it.
Like one of
that's a very interesting.
Good old boy, good old Southern boy. We'll show we're not going to You know, he's there. And let me tell you something. When Ray Gunkel spoke, people jumped. You hear me? People jumped. All of those Tennessee crowds had pieces like Buddy Fuller, Lester Welch.
Well, there's no doubt that Ann Gunkel's life as a whole would have made a great Hallmark movie, of the week or something of that nature. I think it could still be a pitch today to try to do that. But, you know, I remember before the All South wrestling promotion actually took off after Ray's death, there was a back cover of the NWA program for coming up that said coming in Wilbur Schneider, and I my understanding he was a good friend of Ray, and I wonder if that was the first pitch Ann made, because my understanding was she tried to book a match, and that was what really made them realize that she was not going to sit at home, but you know, who knows exactly, but it's just I agree with Jerry on the idea of the Tennessee thoughts or even the Alabama thoughts. We've discussed how nobody could work together. Well, this probably scared the hell out of them. You know, the thought of this woman who actually was well-groomed and knew what she was talking about and could get a lot of sympathy, what it would do to their situation. And, that was extremely scary to them, I'm sure. And, they just couldn't even handle the thought of it. Jerry, how long did you stay with the NWA office after you came in?
A while. Pretty good while. I left for 3 months and come back. I went to Dallas, and then I came back. I'll tell you. I came back in about May of 73, and I stayed a long time.
Okay. I'm not knowledgeable on a lot of this, so I'll ask you, had Ted worked professionally prior to All South kicking off?
Yes, he was in Montgomery. We were both in Montgomery, and I left him there. And because I wanted to come back to Georgia. I wasn't making any money, and I wanted to come back. And so when this all happened, here I am now back with the original office, and Gunkel had just started up. I made a few shots for Gunkel. And like I told you earlier, I was yanked and tugged on, so I went back, and it worked all right, I guess. But then Dickie got a hold of Ted, and then he went with Ann and that group, and it, like I said, I've said in the past, that was the best thing ever for him. That's what he really learned to work, and Tom used him and used him good, and the deal with him and Calvin, that's where they both learned to really work. So it worked out good for him, you know, and it worked out,
right.
I guess, good for a lot of guys. But you know, all this, I'm sure Bobby heard. All this, you know, those guys, are you going to be blackballed? You're going to be this. It was just, I'm telling you, I hated every day working for them.
That blackball went out years ago.
Thank you.
I remember Nick Goodis used to send a blackball sheet around every Monday. We'd get one through the mail. A couple, that's the years it is. He said, turn us some bitch up. He said, if a guy can make me any money, I want to use them. I don't care what Nick Goodis has to say.
There you go. See, Charlie, you know, Charlie's been in the business way longer than me, but I've been around a lot of people. And Charlie knows how these thieves work. He's worked for them. He's worked for them in different territories. He knows. He knows how it went down, man. It's just sickening.
You know, it's hard to fathom the talent that Gunkel had, or that Aaron
right.
had with that run. It's hard to fathom that anybody would have believed that those folks couldn't have went away and got a job somewhere else.
Absolutely.
You know, for somebody. Cause, so that was kind of. Let me throw one other thing in about Ann. We're talking about Ann, and I've talked about her looks and all this other stuff. And Charlie can vouch for this. Ann had a mouth on her. She didn't put up with no
Ooh.
Foolishness. And, buddy, she
don't
could die. Unload on you, son. She used words that sailors would blush at when she got mad.
Yes, she did.
And she was tough. She was tough. So I'm sure she scared some of them folks.
Oh, God. She was talking to your grandma, somebody, cussing like a dog.
I've got about 60 issues of the All South programs. The first 3 or 4 months I don't have. I think I gave those to Bill McMahon at one of the get-togethers we have. But the March 27th, 1973 issue, which is one of the most sought-after issues, is the one that has Charlie Smith on the back cover. tell us how that came about, Charlie.
I just decided one day, I said, well, I think I'll put my picture on the back of the program. You know, I'll make it the program, so I better change. And Charlie Harper, he braves more than hell. And when you got to put your picture on, I said, I'm a star. And we sold out. That's the first time we ever sold out.
How many copies did you buy?
Man, I sold a bunch of them.
Well, I was thinking you bought.
I don't have any left. I got one here in my house.
I've got one in pristine condition. Before we go any further, Mike, are you still with us?
Yeah.
You there?
Yeah, I'm still.
You got any comments on what we've been talking about?
Well, I think, as you guys have mentioned it, the whole ordeal as to how, you know, how they were planning on pushing her out and everything led to, you know, her starting her own thing. And but again, in Jack Briscoe's book, he related to the fact that she started Our goal was to run opposition without even giving them the chance to, you know, do right by her, which I don't believe that, based on all of you guys that were around that situation. And it's something we mentioned here on the show several times, that the real winners out of all that were the fans.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, Atlanta had gotten some coverage, you know, in the national press as far as the wrestling magazines went and everything. But when it kicked off, it really kicked off because you had, you know, the other NWA offices were killing Congress. You know, that's one of the things I'm surprised that the NWA wasn't more careful about. You know, they had worked so hard in setting up in New York with the van and in Minneapolis with Vern to make it look like they weren't a trust. You know, all that was done by cooperation. Those two opposing federations were set up by cooperation with the NWA. But I'm really surprised that they didn't get any sort of scrutiny by bringing in talent from all over the country to make sure that they put her out of business.
Well, that was done to a certain extent. You know, a lot of guys were brought in. Unfortunately, a lot of them, you know, you didn't have the magazines, you didn't have the smart fans to a great extent at that time. So some of these guys that were coming in from the other territories didn't really mean that much unless they, you know, they had worked here. And guys like Bobby Shane, as an example, had totally changed his look and his image. And, you know, they kind of had to start all over again with him. But, yeah, I think it comes down to the same thing we've already talked, you know, we've talked about forever, and Jerry mentions it. Unless they had a piece of the action, promoters didn't want to give up anything. You know, they were too busy trying to worry about how many seats they were going to put in there that week, so they didn't want to take their top guys and send them to Atlanta even for a week, even though it may benefit them later on down the line. So, you know, unless they had some type of pressure or some type of payoff, and I think obviously some did, they weren't all that eager to send talent here to Atlanta to, you know, to help the Atlanta office out, my opinion. Looking at the roster.
I'd like to ask a question.
Go ahead.
I'd like to ask the question. What happened to Sam Mustard during all this stuff?
They didn't want any part of that, Charlie.
You what?
They didn't want. He didn't want any part of that.
That's what I thought.
The biggest
but
help. The biggest help,
when it,
the biggest help when that went down come out of Florida.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eddie
and
come up
it,
here. Eddie was up here quite a bit.
If
he and
you
I
think about
up
it,
some and you know it was. He probably helped them more with his mind too, and you know with the talent he was sending.
Well, if you think about it, from everything that I'd seen when I was working at a radio station down in South Georgia in Albany, the first chance I got to see championship wrestling from Florida, you know that's where the talent was. You know, the programs that were taking place down there and the guys, the matches that were being made, it was far superior to most everywhere else in the country. So if you could get talent out of Florida to come in and help the NWA office, that was exactly where to go to get it.
Well, let me throw another thing at you, I'm just talking from pure business, okay? You mentioned Muchnick. You know, Muchnick and Gunkel were friends, and no doubt had charmed and entertained Muchnick at her home several times. You know, I'm just guessing, okay? Because you know they were all businessmen; they all worked together. When all of this stuff went down, there wasn't an office in this country that knew how that battle was going to come out.
True. That's why they didn't touch it, Bobby.
That's and that's why they didn't touch it. They didn't want to take a side and then that side lose. Then they're on the outs.
That's
they did not. Nobody wanted any part of it. you sit back. If you're in St. Louis or you're in San Francisco with Shire's office or you're in LaBelle's office in L.A. or wherever you were, even though you were part of the NWA, when you looked on paper at the roster that Ann Gunkel started out with when she started
right.
her business, that roster could have filled any promotion anywhere in the world.
Sure.
And
if you
they
look
didn't
at
no
it,
part
and,
of it.
If you look at it, and I'll just run it down here. Assassin 2, Bill Bowman and Joe Turner, Dick Steinborn, Ted Oates, Rock Hunter, Tommy Siegler, Timmy Gohagan, Roberto Soto, Oxbaker, Argentino Apollo, the Avenger, Francisco Flores, Buddy Roberts, Jerry Brown, Charlie Cook, Pedro Godoy, the champ, Jesse James, and several others. I mean, you're looking at opening event guys. You're looking at main eventers here, and these are guys, the main eventers were guys that were appearing in the magazines before and after they, you know, and during All South. So you had not only top guys and guys to fill out the roster, but you had well-known guys, and you also had the guys that the Atlanta area was most familiar with and were satisfied with at that time.
These are the guys that have been putting butts in the auditorium for the last year, year and a half. You know, some of the guys have been here a while.
Right.
Some of them had just started. So, yeah,
right.
It was an interesting time, but yeah, I just, you know, from a business perspective, these guys didn't want no part of that war.
Gotcha.
The only people that wanted a part of it were the ones that thought they were going to benefit from it, and those guys dove head first into it. And if we win, we win. If we don't, we don't. But, you know, they had to take their shot. But the smart guys, they just sat back and watched because they knew it would play out somewhere down the road, and when it played out, you know, they could do business.
From the start of
Bobby.
The promotion, Bobby. Oh, I'm sorry, you talked, Jerry?
Bobby.
When did
Barnett come in?
Do what?
When did Barnett come in?
I'm not sure when Barnett exactly came in. Well, I think it was 73.
We'll look at
that. He got this fuzzes on all the buildings, didn't he?
We're jumping ahead. But when he came
right.
in, Barnett was a businessman. Barnett wasn't
yes.
worried. He hired a booker. You know, he all he was concerned about was business. So when he came in, he just, which would have been a matter of public record, he just went and checked and found out when these contracts come up at these buildings. Because any public building, the Auditorium in Augusta, Civic Center in Savannah, whatever they are, if there's a contract between a promoter and the city, at some point it has to come up for a bid. And all you got to do is outbid whoever your competition is. That's how we lost Augusta. That's how Savannah. Savannah wasn't doing great business down there anyway. It never did with us. But that's how he took the buildings. Is he came in, found out when they came up for bid, got in a bidding war, and by that time, Ann couldn't compete with that money. So
right,
that's
kind of
what happened
there. We won't look at it next week, but that's something down the road is the progression of the NWA office from that point. But from the time the All-South Wrestling Alliance started, how long did it take and what did it take to get into the Atlanta City Auditorium?
Well, we had the same problem in, I say we, Dick had the same problem as the promoter in Columbus. We had the same problem in Atlanta. Any place, what happened basically is this. Most contracts with a building, the contract would read that the building would agree that they would not let an event come in 2 days before or 2 days after your event. In other words, if you were promoting a country western Shower of Stars, Jay, and
right.
You were going to do it on a Saturday night,
right.
The City Auditorium's contract would say Sunday and Monday, or Thursday and Wednesday, no one can come in and promote a country western show, you know, to be in direct competition with you. It was a normal standard contract issue. It was illegal as the day was long. However, it was the way most contracts read. So the problem you had was you would come in, you take you take Mr. Ward in Columbus. He promoted on Wednesday nights. Well, that eliminated Monday and Tuesday. It eliminated Thursday and Friday. All that left was Saturday and Sunday. Of course, the building's booked every Saturday and most Sundays for different events throughout the year. City Auditorium in Atlanta, Thursday, Wednesday, Sunday, Monday. Or, you know, Saturday, Sunday, whatever those 2 days are. I'm getting confused. But they kind of blocked you out so that you couldn't get in there. And then you had all these other days. We've got this in here. We got that in there. And so it turned into a legal battle. And it turned into I know Dick told a story one time. I heard him tell it. Dick took a lawyer and went to a town council meeting in Columbus. And when they told him he couldn't have the building, the lawyer had subpoenas prepared for every member of the town council, and he started handing them out. And he said, "We're going to sue you because this is you're preventing me from doing business." So that's how we got Monday nights in Columbus in the auditorium. Same thing in Atlanta. Atlanta had to fight, and fought a legal battle until finally they agreed to let her have it on Tuesday. And Tuesday was kind of Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. It was kind of 3 days on either side, you know, between cards, and they agreed to let her have it. But we were originally, when we started in business, we were running Friday nights at Oglethorpe head-to-head with them.
Right.
But getting downtown was the key to continue to grow the business, was getting back in that auditorium, because that city auditorium was wrestling to the Atlanta fans.
Right, and you even had to go out to the Lakewood area there a couple of times.
Fairgrounds.
We would go to Lakewood to the fairgrounds when the graduation, high school graduations were going on. The Shrine Circus and the Holiday on Ice. Holiday on Ice came in February. The Shrine Circus was in April, and the graduations ran May and June. So when those things were going on, we would go to Lakewood. We worked the racetrack a couple of times out there for outdoor shows, and then we ran one of the exhibition halls out there.
And you'd mentioned that there was one Omni show, is that correct?
We ran one Omni show, yes.
What was the deal on Carrollton? I guess there was always Griffin and Carrollton on Saturday nights, and I guess the Atlanta office didn't seem to be interested in Carrollton, or was that just something that was made available to all South?
Mr. Butler went with Ann, and he stayed with Ann for... Oh, I don't know, maybe 15 months, 14 months, maybe a year and a half. And then, again, as the talent began to dwindle and we couldn't, you know, it was getting stale, Mr. Butler switched and went back to the Atlanta office. And that's when we started running Porterdale. And Porterdale became a regular Saturday night town. We may have been running Porterdale some before then, but Porterdale became a real stable for us. We drew decent houses there, and we ran it every Saturday night.
All right. I want to throw some names out to you, Charlie, or, Mike, Jerry, if you want to jump in on this. But Charlie and Bobby, you probably know the most about it. Guys that weren't part of the regular roster that were brought in and stayed for a while, or maybe 1 or 2 weeks, were they a plus or a minus to helping the promotion? And the first one I'm going to mention is Carlos Colon.
Well, he was a good worker. He wasn't a household name. I'd never heard of him till I met him. Of course, found out he owned the promotion in Puerto Rico. His business partner, Victor Jovica, would come in and work as well. Victor always was on the, you know, opening match or the second match. But Carlos was a good worker, and they used him in some programs. I would say he was probably an asset more than a hindrance, because he fit in. I've got, you know, it's very odd for any referee other than Charlie Smith to be on the front of the program, since he made the programs up. But you probably have this one, Jay. I got one around here with me raising Carlos Colon and Assassin Two's hand in the auditorium on a Tuesday night.
Right. I've got one picture I was going to mention that is you. It's the July 2nd, 1974 cover which is the first one that I see of you on the cover as the referee.
How did that happen?
Yeah, he must not have had a good picture of himself that week.
I refuse to believe that.
Yeah, Cologne was okay. I mean, you know, I never had any problem with him. He was, again, he was a good worker, so had good matches when he was there.
How about Randy Poffo and Angelo Poffo? Did they do anything for the promotion?
Angelo was at the tail end of his career. People that, you know, the older fans that had seen him on the Chicago, you know, network for the old shows back in the 50s. Early 60s, you know, they knew who he was, but he was, you know, he was never figured into anything prominently. Randy, this was the first place Randy ever worked, as far as I know. He had come off.
He worked under Hood.
Yeah, he worked under Hood. He worked as the spider.
Baseball.
Yeah, he had been playing baseball or was still playing baseball for. So he came in and, you know, he weighed about 160 pounds, soaking wet, and looked like a pencil. And hyperactive, he'd bounce off the walls. But, you know, he was never figured into anything here. Nobody knew who he was because he was always under a hood.
Man Mountain Blackwell, Jerry Blackwell.
Jerry was a local guy. He wrestled under a mask as the Crusader quite a bit. When we had the bear here, he always wrestled a bear every night. But Jerry was always opening match, second match. He never got a big push here. Jerry could do things for his size that I'd never seen a big man do. I mean, he was phenomenal.
Was that drop kick?
Yeah, drop kick, take. I mean, just do anything that, you know. I mean, it was just phenomenal. But he never got a push here. He was always, you know, a low man on the card. He promoted Gainesville, Georgia for Ann and. Couple other little spot shows up there in the North Georgia Mountains up around where he lived, but he never got a push here. He was just
name
recognition at all.
It was interesting because he used what happened here to do pretty well in some other areas, particularly the AWA. And you know, so my opinion is that All South certainly helped get him his start. Ray Candy would be another one that I'd put into that category, right?
Yeah, Ray was you know, this was a Tom helped train Ray, and he got here, got his push here. He did wonderfully well here. This is where, you know, he stayed here almost the whole run, if not the whole run, and he was the first black Georgia heavyweight champion. And he did good here. He had a lot of he helped put some rear ends in some seats because the people here, people bought into him and believed in him.
And obviously they treated him very badly when All South went away, when he went back to work for the NWA promotion. And at least initially, as I remember, having him beaten very quickly. Well, they had him beaten very quickly on TV.
Well, they gave him another
gimmick,
didn't they?
Well, he had several gimmicks over the years, but once he left here, once he got away from here, you know, he went to work for Bill Watts, and Bill treated him okay out there. Bill,
right.
Bill used him well. I mean, it was what it was when he was here. You know, they wanted to kill everybody that was here that had anything to do with Ann that they used on TV anytime relatively soon after the end of the thing, but. Ray did okay.
You had mentioned Jody talking about Tom Ernesto unmasking and what he thought a mistake that was, not only for Tom but for the team. But as things were winding down there, Jody actually unmasked while still working for All South. Did he ever discuss with you what a mistake that was? I mean, I would certainly think it was a mistake.
No, he never said anything. I mean, here again, this is my opinion, okay? And in my opinion, then $2 will get you a cup of coffee. They were near the end of the run. They were gasping at straws. They were doing anything they could to try to draw a crowd. You know, try to keep the business going. And I think that was part of Jody taking the hood off. You know, revealing that he was Larry Hamilton, the Missouri Mauler's brother. You know, I got a picture somewhere, and Jay, you got those programs, so you got it.
Yep.
I got one of those rare programs with him and Tom working as a team without their mask on.
Yep.
You know, I mean, it's just, I think it was just something, and I give Jody credit. Jody committed to Ann, and he stayed the whole run. And I know I've heard him. We've discussed this. He's told me he was wooed. He was promised a lot of things to leave and go somewhere else, but he stayed right here and. You know, he stayed right here the whole run and was true to his word, and I respect him a great deal for that. He just not many places you go today where a man's word you can still go to the bank with it, but with his, I'd go to the bank tomorrow if he told me something. So,
and if you think about it, there was very few masked wrestlers that had gone their whole career. The Destroyer being one of them, but to think of the longevity that he had with that mask, and of course afterwards it was like it never took place, but it was still, you know, giving away your who you were to the audience by unmasking like that. It had to, I agree with you, it had to be, you know, real loyalty to the company to do something like that.
Right.
On the other end, let's talk about a couple, and you've talked about him before, but whose idea was it to bring Dr. Jerry Graham in here?
I have no idea. It's one of Charlie Smith's favorite people.
How
did that work, Charlie?
Well, you know, he had a bad habit of peeing in people's cars or whatever. That in here, and Tom said, "Karen Athens." I said, "Tom, if he pees in my car, I'll leave him there. I don't care what you say or anybody else. Sure enough, he peed in my car, and I told him to find him a way back to Atlanta. He didn't know where he was at anyway. He was left out left field."
And that night that Charlie Smith left him there, I had to bring him back to Atlanta, and I had somebody riding with me, some kid named Ted Oates from Columbus. He was with me, and me and him, I had come from Columbus. My first wife lived in Columbus, not too far from Ted, and I had been down there, and we drove together to Athens, and we're going back to Columbus that next night, and then we had to go to Savannah on Friday night. And we wound up having to come back to Atlanta to bring him home because Charlie Smith left him there. So it was a fun film night. But Jerry Graham was one of those people. We've talked about this before on the show about the it factor, whatever that is, and I don't know how you describe it. But whatever it is, he had it. He could walk into a building and people hated him. He didn't have to open his mouth. He just had to walk in. And he drew heat. He was knowledgeable of the business. He was one of those people that he did everything he did in the ring was for a reason. He didn't do anything without thinking it out. And once he got in the ring, he was all right. But it was just the outside antics and the things that, you know, poor old Bill Bowman told the story about when they were in Puerto Rico about Jerry coming in one night. He was staying at the El San Juan Hotel and it had a pool in the lobby. And he come in and jumped in the pool with all his clothes on and proceeded to strip. And he could float like a battleship. He just rolled over on his back, was floating around butt naked in the lobby of the El San Juan Hotel in the pool. And they tracked Bill Bowman down, who was staying somewhere else, to come over and talk him out of the pool. So, yeah, he just – the outside antics, he just – like Charlie says, he didn't know where he was. He was so he was so gone mentally that, you know, you couldn't do nothing with him. But – I don't know who. I guess they were grasping at straws and taking whatever talent they could get.
It's that same end. How did bringing in names like Ernie Ladd and Ox Baker, who were, you know, magazine cover darlings and were well known there, was it
did they make a difference, or was it by that time was it too little too late?
Well, Ox was there just about the whole run. He was there when we first when,
that's
when the
right,
thing first started.
He and Akbar were the Georgia Tag Team
Georgia
champions,
Tag Team champions, right. And but the Ernie Ladd coming in, yeah, he made a heck of a difference. He brought him in. We brought him in here as a babyface. He was in a lot of the magazines as a big heel. You know, he had the king gimmick and wore the crown. Well, we brought him in here as a babyface, and we put him against the likes of Ox Baker and whoever else, you know, we could work him with. Cowboy Bob Ellis, they brought him in to be his partner a couple of times in Atlanta. You know, and there again, Ellis was way past his prime, but he was still a big name in Atlanta from years gone by. So all of these guys made an impact. But the thing
Mascaris,
that lasted 2 weeks. But you know, the thing with Ernie Ladd is it got old after a time, because Ernie would come in and he would, you know, he worked with Ox 100 times, but then you had to start working with other people, and it just
near the end of the run,
the main event was him and Don Serrano, and that was like Samson and Goliath, or
right,
David
Super
Goliath.
Soul Davis.
Yeah, Super Soul Davis. So it was a. You know,
did one more I'll throw out, and then we'll move on from this. But overall, was Thunderbolt Patterson a plus or a minus?
When he first came, he was a super plus. He was a plus as long as he was here, as long as he worked. The people bought him. The crowds got bigger. Everywhere we went, people were flocking to see him. He was a good worker in the ring. He was in the dressing room. He didn't, you know, he would talk, but he didn't talk a lot. He would sit and read, and you know, never had any problem. And then I'm not sure what happened. I'm sure it boiled down to money, but he probably thought he should be getting more money or whatever. I'm not sure what the case was, and that's neither here nor there. But when he left. And then again, him and Jim tried to run some shows, and they started
right.
making statements. You know, they brought the tried to play the race card, and I can honestly say I never saw that. I never even had an inkling of that, or you know. But he was a great asset to Ann when he first got here.
I would have certainly said the same thing. I was just wondering if the way he left, and you pretty well explained that. Turn that plus into a minus if it really caused that much problem for the promotion as far as the fans were concerned.
Well, you know, there again, you know, I told this story before, but, you know, we got word one time. We were running on Tuesday night, and I don't, you know, and we got word somehow or another, and it was going around a dressing room that Thunderbolt and Jim Wilson were going to come to the matches that night, and they were going to jump in the ring. Well, that's what we heard. So probably second or third match that night, I was in the dressing room. I wasn't in the ring at the time, and we heard a rumbling out there, and something was going on. Walked downstairs to the stage and peeped out, and Thunderbolt and Jim Wilson had bought a ticket, and they were sitting on about the fourth row at ringside. Well, you know, we don't know now what, you know, we're all looking at one another. Nobody's saying anything, and Tom looked at John Foley, and he said, go down and sit at the table at ringside. He said, go to the timekeeper's table and sit there and stay there the rest of the night. So John went and sat down there. There was never anything said. There was never anything, you know. John just went and sat down there. And needless to say, nobody jumped in the ring that night. After the matches were over, they held a prayer meeting. They got up by the ring, and a bunch of people was listening to them. And, you know, it's not hard to incite people making a speech, and that kind of happened. But that was after the matches. Nothing was said. Nothing was done. It was just, you know, it delayed me from taking the ring down that night and storing it so I could go home. But other than that, there was never any big deal there.
November the 5th, 1974 is the last program that I've got, and I assume that was either the last week or the next to the last week.
Pretty close.
How much, which honestly ran it right at 2 years,
yeah.
how much advance time did anybody get that that was it?
Don't know about Smitty. I found out the last show was in Montezuma, Georgia, on a Friday night in the National Guard Armory. Dick was promoting it, and we got to the town that night. And when I got there about 7:15, 7:20, Charlie Harbin's car was in the parking lot, and I knew something was up because Charlie in 2 years had never made a spot show. And went to the dressing room. I got dressed, and we were in two separate rooms. It was divided by a portable wall. I don't know what you call them, you know, like the curtains that pulled to and snapped. And the thing opened, and Charlie was in the Hill dressing room, and he opened the little curtain. He said, "You guys come over here. We need to talk." And we went over there, and he told us, he said, "Fellas," he said, "tonight is it. This is it. It's our last show." And he said, payday will be Monday like always. He said, however, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, he said, Jim Burnett will be in our office in Atlanta. He said, if any of you guys would like some help getting booked into another territory, come to the office in the morning and meet with him. And he's made some contacts. There's some people that are interested in you guys working, and if you want help, be there in the morning at 9 o'clock. And then he turned around, looked at me, said, "I need to see you." And he called me off to the side. He told me, he said, "Stay away from the office tomorrow." He said, "Don't come to the office." And I went, "Okay." And he said, "You're being taken care of." That's all he said. And I asked him, I said, "What about the TV station, The Ring, tomorrow?" He said, "Don't go to the TV station. Leave it alone." And I said, "Okay." So that was how much notice I got.
Was it pretty much the same for you, Charlie?
Yeah. I didn't even go to that town that night. I already knew.
Bobby, you have discussed... All right. Bobby, you have discussed how you were basically taken care of, but were you actually out of work for any time at all?
No, sir. I got up Saturday morning, and I was at home, and I did not know what being taken care of meant. And I was sitting there with my wife, and I told her, I said, "I do not know what's happening." And I said, "I don't know if I have a job. I don't know if I've got to go look for one." I said, I don't know. So after about 10 o'clock, I just had all I could stand. I got in my car and went to the office. And when I walked in, Harbin seen me, and the first thing Harbin did was scream at me, wondering what I was doing there. And I went in his office, and I told him, I said, "Charlie," I said, "you told me I was being taken care of." I said, "I don't know what taking care of means." I said, "I'm, what do I do? Just sit there and wait on the phone to ring or what?" And he said, "Just go home." I know now Charlie was protecting me because out of 31 guys on the roster, I was the only one that had a job that didn't have to move. And as I was leaving Charlie's office, Barnett saw me. I'd never met Jim Barnett. And he said, "Charlie, is that Bobby?" And Charlie said, "Yes." He said, "Tell him come here." And he took me in a little office there. He was using Tom's office. And he brought me in there, and he said, "Bobby, I understand you drive the ring truck and put the ring up." And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I understand you referee." He said, "I understand you know how to build and repair rings." I went, "Yes, sir." He said, "I want you to meet at my office Monday morning at 9 o'clock and meet my booker, Harley Race." He says, "I have a job for you." So, no, I never had any time down. I was off that Sunday, and we weren't running on Sundays at the time, so it was just a normal Sunday off. And that Monday morning, I went in at 9 o'clock, met Harley Race, and I had a job. So the good Lord took care of me in a wonderful way. It was a wonderful thing for me, and like I say, it worked out well for everybody, I think, in the long run. But I was just so blessed that I didn't have to pack up and leave. And I'll be honest, referees at the time, it was hard to call somewhere else and get a job as a referee. Because everybody had their own guy. They either worked in the office or, that's the way Jim Ross got started. He refereed and drove the ring truck and drove Mr. McGurk around, and he worked in the office. And, of course, he led into the TV part of it. But that's what he was doing at the same time I was doing it in Atlanta.
So, sounds like that would be a good subject to do one night. Thank you.
Yeah, you couldn't call and say, "Hey, I'm a referee. I'd like to come in," because they
there
were very
sense.
Few that could do that.
I want to hear more about that, gentlemen. We've been on the air for 90 minutes tonight. I think we've had an extremely good conversation, Jerry. I thank you for your comments, and I know you got to get up in the morning, right? Uh-oh, I think Jerry's gone. Must have knocked him off. Thank you, Jerry, for your comments. You there?
No, that was me.
Jerry. Oh, okay. I guess he must have knocked off and had to go. So we'll talk with Jerry next week. Bobby, I want to thank you very much for your conversation this evening, and you too, Charlie. Mike, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Any final thoughts? What, Charlie?
We'll spike a lot of work tomorrow.
Absolutely. Mike, any final thoughts you want to leave us with?
Well, don't know what shape I'll be in next Thursday to be able to call in, but what they're just to give you an idea, my surgery is supposed to start at 9:30 in the morning. It's supposed to go anywhere from 6 to 10 hours. It could even go up to 14. And then I will be in ICU. Probably the bulk of the weekend. I'm hoping to get back on in a regular room by Sunday at the latest, or Monday. But what the surgeon has told me is that once they put me out on tomorrow morning, I won't. I'll probably sleep straight through until Saturday morning. But he's very optimistic. They've all told me I've got plenty of, forgive me if this gets a little graphic, but I've got plenty of intestinal material for them to work with. That I should be after a certain length of time after the surgery's done and everything, and after I've recovered and after I've gone home. That 6, 7, 8 weeks down the road, I may be pretty well back to normal as far as my digestive system goes. And then from there, of course, then we've got to look into the hip replacement and then figure out what's going on with my my feet and regaining the capability of walking. But this thing, and those of you that know me and have had private conversations with me, I know Bobby knows better than anybody, that this ostomy thing has been the absolute worst of it. And once it's gone, I'll feel like I'm not just halfway home. I'll be three-quarters of the way home, because once I get everything under control and, I'm back functioning somewhat normally as far as the digestive part of it goes, that'll allow me to do things again. It'll allow me to, be able to go to church again. It'll allow me to be able to go out for dinner again and stuff like that, and not have to worry about, this unsightly, nasty thing that's hanging off my side. So, I want to thank everybody for, not only you guys, but everybody that's reached out to me on Facebook and text messages and everything. This has been a long, hard road for me, and there's been a lot of times that I don't mind admitting that I just soon wanted to just throw my hands up and give up. But, I've had a lot of people praying for me and keeping me in their thoughts and prayers that have kept me going. And I appreciate each and every one of them and love each and every one of you that have done that. And I know with that continued support that we're going to get through this. In fact, Jerry and I made a pact the other day. As soon as I am over all this and am walking again, he and I are going to team up. We're going to face somebody. We're going to get one more match out of both of us.
It means a lot, Mike, that you were able to join us tonight. And as far as I'm concerned, based on your attitude, I, I think you've got nothing to worry about, and we're certainly optimistic for you and hope for the very best, and we'll leave it up to Bobby to bring us up to date on what's happening with you next, and it's going to be positive, I'm sure of that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I ain't going to bug you. I was going to call you, but I ain't going to bug you. I'll just tell you here. I love you, brother. Do what they tell you to do. Get well. And, again, if that doctor says I can stand in and help hold instruments in the morning, call me.
Charlie,
you
took me.
Do what?
I'm not going to know anything. Go away.
Yeah, I know it. Well, tomorrow
Charlie,
night I have the pleasure of doing a wedding rehearsal for Bill Drummond's granddaughter, and I'll be marrying her on Saturday night, so I have a good weekend planned.
Sounds good. We appreciate you joining us again, Mike, and best of luck. Bobby, thanks for all your comments tonight, and you too, Charlie. And I think we had an excellent show, and we'll try to do at least a mediocre one next week. I thank you very much. Good night to everybody.
Thank you for having me, sir.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.